You may be able to tell by what's on the board behind me that we are not going to continue this morning with our list of words. It is Christmas Eve, and I think it's important to talk about a few things there. You've been to the worship service? What was the scripture lesson that Travis worked from? Luke 2, starting in... Good, so he left away the first seven verses, right? Let's go work on that. If you can find Luke chapter 2. I want to look at the first seven verses with him. I want to start by asking you, a question. I'm going to read this out of my translation. You follow along in yours. And the question I want to ask you is this. I want to know how inspiring and how theologically deep are the sentences that you're about to hear. It happened at this time, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be made of the whole inhabited world. Is there deep theological significance in that? Sounds like somebody's telling you a fact, right? This census, the first, took place while Quirinius was governor of Syria, and everyone went to be registered, each to his own hometown, Any great theological significance arise yet? So Joseph set out from the town of Nazareth in Galilee for Judea to David's town called Bethlehem, since he was of David's house in line, in order to be registered together with Mary, his betrothed, who was with child. Another little list of facts. It happened that while they were there, the time came for her to have her child, and she gave birth to a son, her firstborn. She wrapped him in swaddling clothes and laid him in a manger because there was no room for them in the inn. Thank you very much. Did you see any great theological significance in those words? There is. But you don't see them in the words themselves. The words take on weight when you put them into a larger context and begin to realize what's being said through them. Luke is a historian, in addition to being a doctor. He's simply telling you some facts. Now, there are a couple of interesting things in here, and I want to chase a couple of those. Let me chase the first one first. What was that last word? In. Okay, now, I need you to understand, I'm not a Greek scholar, but I do read what Greek scholars say. Is there any other place in the New Testament that you can remember, in the Gospel specifically, that you can remember the word in appearing? Can you think of another place? I think you can get it if you think about it. In the story of the Good Samaritan, somebody, the person was lying broken and bleeding from the beating he got from the robbers. First person passes by, second person passes by. Third person, who should have been of any of them, the one to pass by, didn't pass by, bound him up and took him to an inn, treated him as best he could with oil and bandages and so forth, and then did what? Left the money with whom? The innkeeper, so that he would take care of it. And he said to the innkeeper, now if you spend more than what I've left with you, the next time I come through, I'll make you whole. So here's my question. Where's the innkeeper in the words we just read? Have you been to a pageant? Have you been there? Have you seen? Just outside the door, did any of you notice as you walked in this morning? The costumes that are sitting out there? They're not costumes big enough for us, some of us. Little bitty costumes. Because they're for children, right? And in the children's pageants at Christmas, there's typically an innkeeper. Is there an innkeeper in these words? There's a reason for that. In the story of the Good Samaritan, the word that's translated in is, using English letters anyway, pandocheion, or something close to that. What's the first half of that word look like?
Did it look like anything
did? I had somebody come up to me this morning and say, I said, how's Christmas? Is things going well? The guy said, oh, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. It was awful last year. It's wonderful this year. So what's the difference?
said the 3 2-year-olds are now 3 3-year-olds. Can I give you a clue to what that
okay. I am told that the word actually has some pieces to it by one of the Greek scholars that was in the first hour. This has terminology that talks about lots of different people, and a stride is a piece of that, as if it sits on a road and it deals with all kinds of people. Okay? That's the word that's used in what we just read. And my translation does not use the word in, it uses the word living space. My translation doesn't sell very well. The translation you read sells wonderfully. Why? Because when people go to buy a translation, they go to familiar passages to see what it says. It doesn't say in. Terrible translation. They put the thing aside, I suspect. There's a number of places like this where the term has gotten into the translation, but maybe the word actually means something else. Now, there is one other place in the New Testament where that word is used. I think it's in Luke 22, but don't go there because I didn't look it up and I'm not sure, but I think it's under there. Jesus sent his disciples into the city just before Passover with instructions to go and find a certain man and say to that man, prepare the kataluma. And what they were preparing for was the Last Supper. What do we call that space? The upper room. Mine calls it the living space. Why would you call living space the upper room? Time out for a minute. A long time ago, we took a trip up into Canada, drove along the St. Lawrence Seaway for a while, and then came back from that point straight into the United States, almost straight south. We hit the northernmost point in Maine, which isn't near the coast. It's a couple hundred miles inland. And there's a road up there that goes almost straight as an arrow due south. Almost no cities or towns on that road. It's just 300 miles of barren country land. But there's an occasional farm and farmhouse. Those farmhouses don't look like farmhouses down here. You get up to Maine, you get into Wisconsin, you get into North or South Dakota, even some parts of Pennsylvania, the farms and their buildings don't look like they look down here. My granddaddy had a farm, and I remember how his buildings looked. There was a house over here, there was a barn over there. Up there, how do they build it? It's all connected. You got the house over here, you got the barn over here, you got all kinds of stuff in between, but it's all connected. Why is it connected? This isn't difficult. Why is it connected? Because when it gets cold in the middle of winter, you don't want to go outside to go back inside to take care of the animals. So you just go through. Okay. So what would an upper room imply if another translation for it was living space? You build two stories, and downstairs is where the animals come in, and upstairs is where the people live. Now, it can get a little bit more complicated than that because, again, the Greek scholars this morning added this piece that one of these says a piece of this word, I think it's this part over here, talks about beside or adjoining, as if maybe you have the house here and it's the adjoining, which would be more the picture of the houses up in, the farmhouses up in Pennsylvania or Maine or wherever. So far, okay? Now, if that's so, then that says, pardon me just a minute, she did great. I left singing with your daughter. Merry Christmas to you. You didn't get to go to the other church, but did Corey sing in yours? Did Corey Mallory Coble sing in yours? She sang in the traditional service today. She's wonderful. Anyway, lost my train of thought. The picture is, the baby wasn't born in the living space, and it says there wasn't any room for them there. Now, there could be at least two big reasons that I can see why that might not be. One is, there was a census going on. Everybody's coming to town. You don't put relatives into a motel in those days. You don't do it much now without having a little bit of a bad feeling about it, at least not if you were raised where I was raised. We're getting ready to go to Tennessee for a few days to see my mother. One of the questions is, do we stay at a hotel or do we stay with relatives? Well, not right to stay in a motel. Not you know, there's something about the, if you go to a motel, you're insulting the people who could give you hospitality. If they don't give you hospitality, they're insulting you. Now, that's not so much in our day, but it was huge back then. For Joseph to go back to his hometown and not have somebody offer him hospitality would have been somewhat insulting. But maybe that happened. The other possibility is it's just too crowded, and you don't want to have a baby where all the people are. So, you know, you go off someplace where it's quiet. But you go off someplace where it's quiet, you still want shelter. Maybe that's what happened. Okay? Keep an eye on both of those thoughts. Because that's sort of... Sorry?
Would they have been shunned because she wasn't married yet?
That's the other big one. Remember back up there, in order to be registered, this is verse 5, with Mary, his betrothed, who was with child. The process of getting married back then, you had a long engagement. And during that time, you did not live as man and wife. And all of a sudden, Mary shows up pregnant. There's a social stigma with that in those days. Lessening son now. It's not gone. But it was huge back then. It's very hard to imagine a large family without some in the family, if not many in the family, if not most in the family, if not practically all in the family, joining in the shunning. Either one could have been a cause, and probably both together were what was going on. And keep an eye on that, because that's going to show up a little bit more. Now, can anybody figure out what I'm trying to do this morning? I'm trying to help you take a look at the Christmas story and see a little bit more of the reality of it, because the reality is more powerful than some of the barnacles that get built up on it. So, with that sort of preliminary,
let's go back to this.
If you were challenged with filling in these two blanks, what would you say?
The Christmas story is primarily, or first of all, this,
but it's also something else. Could you put two things side by side that would fit that thought? What would you say?
Christmas is primarily, first of all, this, but it's also...
Can you think of anything to put there?
I'll wait.
Christmas story is first of all spiritual, but it is also earthy.
And I was trying to point out, as you read the Christmas story, it isn't spiritual in the words themselves. It's what stands behind those words and what they represent that brings those extra dimensions on it. What else?
Oh, what?
Magical divine.
Help me understand what you mean by magical.
Well, first of all, it's magical. It's like things happening that are surreal. The angel and the virgin birth and miracles.
Miraculous. Yeah. If so, the contrasting word probably shouldn't be divine, because that's the area in which the extra is there.
It's unbelievable, but it's divine.
Okay, let me give you what the first hour said at this point.
They said it's believable and unbelievable at the same time. That's not all of what you're saying. You're saying supernatural and matter of fact.
I think it's magical and divine. It's like something we love.
Mystical, like how the angels and the angel commission. Oh my goodness. But it's also divine. It is from God. So it's what it is.
Okay.
It's joyous. I think I understand. Yeah.
Good.
My son, who's three, carries around a Santa Claus that his grandfather gave him. He presses his hand and he says, "The magic of Christmas lies in here." And it is. It's this sort of a fantasy, like, you know, with snow falling down. And part of that comes from, I think, the way the story is portrayed. But it's also rooted in a divine reality that resonates.
If you'll let me put divine reality here, I think that will help me.
Joyous and redemptive.
Hold on.
I was going to say prophecy and reality.
He said joyous and redemptive, and then he said prophecy and reality. I put hope and sight. You may remember that when Paul wrote 1 Corinthians 13, he says there was faith, there's hope, charity. The day's going to come when hope will become, I guess faith will become sight. And where things we believe will come, actually come. You begin to actually see them. And I hear some of that in what you're saying. Now,
are they common and miraculous?
Okay. Yeah.
This is what I tried to teach the middle schoolers.
That may be harder in here.
I would fill those blanks in with, first of all, God's Son, but it's also God's forgiveness.
Okay. Well, remember how the book of John tells the Christmas story? Pardon? It sure doesn't tell the Christmas story in a way that is recognizable at Christmas. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. One sentence. Very different way of telling the Christmas story. In the first hour, somebody said, you talk about a cradle, but the shadow of the cross is still there. Jesus is a baby, but Jesus is Savior. But back there, this man.
Light and darkness.
Light and darkness. Travis emphasized that a bit last week by taking you into Revelation 12, which is a very different kind of Christmas story. Very different kind of Christmas story, and yet still has that. Yes, sir.
Well, I was just trying to get, I don't know if I can go with these words, but on the one hand, it's very stressful. You talked about that a little bit. If you were telling the story outside of the context, with everybody clucking their thumbs and saying, oh, they didn't treat her very well, and, oh my gosh, you know, what a horrible time, you know, they had to travel all that way. You know. And on the other hand, you've got the, in the context, of course, it's eternally miraculous. I'm not sure exactly how to.
Yeah, and the stress might actually have been inverted at the time. We can stand here and say, oh, how terribly she was treated. If she was actually treated in a shunning kind of way, people might have felt, you know, this is what we have to do to be faithful to the law, to be faithful to God's judgments and instructions. And yet, I've written down so much was given. Yes, ma'am.
I think it's the story is eternal, in a sense, you know, the story has always been for God, I think. And yet it's incarnational, so it occupies a certain moment in time. It goes from this, it stretches backwards and forward, but then it occupies this one moment.
Good. Yeah. That's maybe enough for right now. What I want to try to do now is move us a little bit further into exploring a little bit more of this in the hopes that when we finished with this time this morning, you'll at least have a few things to think about in Christmas story that maybe you hadn't thought about before, hadn't thought of in this way. So let me begin by taking you for just a moment. I want to flesh out this idea of possibly one of the reasons why Mary was where she was when Jesus was born, because the family didn't let her in, you know, the hospitality that should have been open to her. I think privacy can explain almost as much of it, so I don't think you need to necessarily go there, but I think you might correctly go there.
Plus, the line of David was 1,000 years old, and there had to have been life.
Yeah. I'm going to encourage you to put something in the place of Luke 2. Don't lose that place, because you're going to get frustrated to try to get back to it. But I want to take you for just a moment to Isaiah 53. Yes.
Why do you think that she would not want a prophecy? I mean, as a woman having a baby, you want to have people around you to help you. You don't want to do that by yourself. I mean, that's how that culture was. It seemed like there was always, you know, midwives and people around to help you.
I think that's part of the reason why I think privacy is not the whole of the story. I think it might be the whole story, but I'm inclined to think there might be more to it. Yeah. Found Isaiah 53? Still got a bookmark back in Luke 2? You haven't lost that, right? Okay.
Verse 1. And I'm hoping you're going to hear this a little bit differently. Who has given credence to what we have heard? Who has seen in it a revelation of the Lord's arm?
You were saying back here, stressful, and yet, and you couldn't find the words, and I couldn't find the words either, but I think Isaiah 53:1 almost does. Who can see in this the eternal, the divine reality, the matter of fact butted up against the supernatural? Who can see past the human picture that the story is, to see the truth that's larger, that stands behind it? Do you hear the power of that first verse out of Isaiah 53?
Who has given, who's believed what we've heard? Who has seen in it a revelation of God at work?
And that's the who would have thought God's power would look like this?
That's wonderful. Yeah. Who would have thought God's power would look like this? That's just about perfect. Like a sapling, he grew up before him. Like a root in arid ground. He had no form or charm to attract us, no beauty to win our hearts. Verse 3. He was, what's your word?
Despised.
Just let that word hang a second. He was despised. The lowest of men. A man of sorrows, familiar with suffering, one from whom, as it were, we averted our gaze. And then it repeats in my translation that word again. Does it do that in yours?
Yeah.
Is despised shown a second time? One for whom we had no regard, yet ours were the sufferings he was bearing. Ours the sorrows he was carrying. While we thought of him as someone being punished and struck with affliction by God, in fact, he was being wounded for our rebellions, crushed because of our guilt. Now here's what I want to take you back to. First, that repetition of the word despised. Keep your eye on that. And then the next part, a man of sorrows familiar with suffering.
When was Jesus familiar with suffering? When did Jesus suffer? On the cross. The last day? The last few hours of his life. Would you say someone is acquainted with suffering?
a man of sorrows because of what happened on the last day of his life and not the rest of his life? Does that make sense to you?
It's separate from Jerusalem.
Something's been going on his whole life. And the word despised is the bookends. Do you hear it? I'm still shunned. I'm still looking at that word shunned. Because I think that's a piece of reality that we don't often see. I don't know that. Yes, Bobby.
Well, it seems so much more theological now in this context, thinking about God sent his Son and Christ came for us. And he must have suffered a whole lot knowing why he sent him.
And that might be right. But I think there's a little more, and I think we get a glimpse of it in Mark. So if you can leave Isaiah, don't lose Luke. Don't lose Luke. We're going to go there in a minute. I hope I have time to do all these things. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. Wherever you got your bookmark, back up two books from there. One book from there, Mark. And I want you to go to chapter 6. And I want you to watch for a word, because it's going to come, at least if your translation parallels mine. Mark chapter 6, verse 1. Leaving that district, he, that is Jesus, went to his hometown, and his disciples accompanied him. Where's Jesus' hometown?
Nazareth.
That's where he went. With the coming of the Sabbath, he began teaching in the synagogue. And most of them were astonished when they heard it. And they said, where did the man get all this? What is this wisdom that has been granted him and these miracles that are worked through him? This is the carpenter, surely, the son of Mary, the brother of James and Joseph and Jude and Simon. His sisters too, are they not here with us? And they would not accept him.
They took offense
at him. And Jesus said to them, a prophet is despised in his own country. Does yours use that word? King James, I think, says, is not without honor except in his own country. And that doesn't capture this word. Do you hear this word? Assuming it's accurate. There's an echo of those bookends back in Isaiah. He's gone away. He's come back. And the despising is still there. Who would have thought God's power could show up this way? Wow. Among his own relations and in his own house. And he could work no miracles there. Except that he cured a few sick people by laying his hands on them. He was amazed at their lack of faith.
Some of this has come from the original shunning.
Well, I'm simply saying, I don't discount that possibility. I don't know. It could have been simply some privacy is needed and got all this crowd of people in the living space. Let's just go off here in the corner. And that makes all kinds of sense. That might be right. But when I lay these things side by side, I'm sensing Jesus has had an experience that relatively few people have had of not being welcomed at his birth. Yes, sir?
I'll try to find it, but I can't. I'm pretty sure there's a verse when the Pharisees are confronting him, they say that he was born in sin.
I couldn't find that one either, but I found two more, and we're going to go to those in just a second.
Did that ring a bell to
you? Oh, yeah. I couldn't find that one, but I found two. I found two parallels. There's three that I know of, and I found two of them. We're going to go there in just a second.
Okay. But it was a humble beginning of a man that was the epitome of humility.
Yeah.
I think it's right in keeping that Jesus would be born that way. Because he was not an American king. mean, to me, it fits in line with what he lived.
Despised and rejected.
No, a humble beginning.
I understand, right. But Isaiah says despised, rejected, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief.
And despised to this day. And rejected.
Who did Jesus go to and get roundly criticized for?
Tax collectors,
prostitutes,
Samaritan women. At a well in the middle of the day when it was just the woman and the man. And everything he did seemed like he got criticized for it. But there's a common theme in much of what he did. His common theme, one of them, was to reach out to people that nobody reached out to. When lepers came to him for healing, he did the unthinkable. He touched them. Where did that come from? It's easy to say it came because he's the Son of God. And I will grant you there's power in that thought. But it also, I think, came from his own experience of knowing what it felt like to be an outcast. And I want you to hear that in the Christmas story this year. Because I think it's there. I think it's there. I'm not sure, but I think it's there. Yes, ma'am.
I've been reading the prophets a lot, and it just makes so much sense that Christ would experience that again in an incarnational form, because God the Father had experienced it. He cried it out to the prophets, all of them. He rejected me. I've been your God, and you've left me over and over and over again, that sense of rejection of being the Holy One and then being treated as if he is dirt, you know. That wasn't the first time that God had experienced that when Christ experienced it.
He experienced it on a regular basis.
Can I read you something for just a second? Right there in Mark. I read it, and you don't recognize it for what it is. Where did the man get all this? What is this wisdom that's been granted him? And these miracles that are worked through him? This is the carpenter, surely. The son of who? Mary. Here's the song sheet for the morning. Here are the hymns that they give to the people in the choir loft, because it's too hard to carry a hymn book and all the other kind of stuff we carry, so they photocopy this thing off for us. Here on the right-hand side is the hymn we closed with. Somebody came up to me after the service and said, "You didn't sing after the first hymn, after the first verse of that hymn." I said, "You're right." He said, "I hope you were thinking about something pleasant." And I said, "No, I was thinking about Sunday school lesson." Here's the chorus. This is Christ the King, whom shepherds guard and angels sing. Haste, haste, to bring him laud, the babe, the son of Mary. And we sing that and we think, oh, that's so wonderful. You know how many times in the New Testament somebody is called the son of so-and-so? 200 times. You know how many of those the son of, and it names a woman? One. Mark 6. One. Mark 6. Isn't this the carpenter? Son of Mary. And you can almost hear him spit. Am I reading this right? I don't know. But I think it's here. A studied insult. I believe. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I don't know if it overlays this discussion or not.
Come out, just, sir. Listen. Listen. Listen.
It's a miracle.
The timing is good. I didn't know if this would work. I didn't think to do this in the first hour. They're singing that song right now. Yes, sir.
One thing that's abundantly clear is that Christ had the ultimate vision. I mean, from some point, and it's hard to say, well, maybe beginning with his public ministry, he had a very clear vision. Everything he did, every step he took, every word he uttered, was a direct journey up to the end. And then you ask yourself the question, when did it begin? Did it begin with his public ministry? Or did it begin in his formative years? Or did it begin right then?
And that's the question I'm just asking. Did it start in the Christmas story?
The way I would answer it is, well, who was the author of the vision? God was the author. So it was in place from day one.
I just want to make sure, as you read the Christmas story, hear the development of the temper of Jesus. The experiencing of everything that bad that can come to human beings. Innocent or not. Go to John 8. We're going to do this one quickly because I've got two or three more important things. Additional important things. Not more important. Additional important things to do. John 8, chapter 12. Jesus says, I am the light of the world. Anyone who follows me will not be walking in the dark, but will have the light of life. I will tell you, I am twisting scripture as we go into this next little section. There's at least one other explanation for this that doesn't follow the line I'm going to offer to you today. I am the light of the world, Jesus says. Anyone who follows me will not be walking in the dark, but will have the light of life. At this, the Pharisees said to him, this is verse 13, you are testifying on your own behalf. Your testimony is not true. Testimony was not true. Except it is true unless there were two witnesses. You're talking about this yourself. There's no other witness. Jesus says in verse 14, even though I'm testifying on my own behalf, my testimony is still true because I know where I've come from and where I'm going. You don't know where I come from and you don't know where I'm going. You judge by human standards. I don't judge anyone, but if I did judge, my judgments will be true because I'm not alone. The one who sent me is with me. In your law, it's written, the testimony of two witnesses is true. I testify on my own behalf, and the Father who sent me testifies on my behalf too. And they asked him, what? Where is your Father? Do you hear it? And Jesus answered, you don't know me, so you don't know my Father. If you knew me, you'd know my Father. Still in that chapter, verse 41. Jesus said to them, you are doing your Father's work. And they replied, we weren't born illegitimate. That's two of them. I don't know where the third one is. Now, there's another way to read every one of those. It's much more innocent and much less pointed than this way. But I simply say, the words are there, especially in Mark 6. The word, in my translation, despised by his family, by his friends, by the people who knew him best. He was despised, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. Now, I want to go two other places very, very quickly. First of all, I want to go to Luke 1. Did you still have Luke? You still have Luke? Go to Luke 1. Okay, now we're going to try to move a little bit quickly to be able to do three things before we quit. Luke chapter 1, verse 26. First two or three words. In the sixth month of what?
Elizabeth.
In the sixth month of the year? No, in the sixth month of Elizabeth's pregnancy. Now, hang on a second. You got to go to verse 5 and through verse 25. That is the preceding section. And what you find out is there was a woman named Elizabeth who was so old and had not had any children, it was assumed she would never have children. Her husband was a priest. He served in the temple. And on one particular day, he was the one chosen to go into the Holy of Holies with sacrifice. Now, if you know how this works, some of you may not know this, we're told that in this time, one priest would be chosen for this service. He would do it once, maybe once in his whole life, I don't know. But he would have a rope tied around his waist, and he would go into the Holy of Holies, and if anything went wrong, they could at least drag him out without having to go in. You don't go in and dust in the Holy of Holies. Only the priest goes in, and only with the sacrifice, with the blood of the sacrifice. He goes in, and he sees somebody in there. And what he sees is an angel. And the angel tells him, I think it's in verse 19, who he is. I am Gabriel, who stands in God's presence, and I have been sent to speak to you and to bring you this good news. What's the good news? Your wife's going to have a baby. And you're going to name him John. And he's going to do all kinds of things, and the angel tells him that. But, he says, since you didn't believe me, how could he believe? Elizabeth was past childbearing age. This doesn't happen. Since you didn't believe me, you're going to be speechless. You're going to be unable to speak or communicate. And he comes out, and he can't speak. What happened to him inside? He can't speak. And the implication is, he can't communicate in any way whatsoever. But Elizabeth has a baby. And in her 6 month of her pregnancy, Gabriel comes to Mary. What did Travis say? Remember Travis said shepherds had questions and so did Mary? What was Mary's question? What are you? No. What are you talking about? Remember, that's why he said it. I know the words say, how can these things be? Travis transliterated that in our service. Did he do that? What are you talking about? And the moment the angel says, oh, and your cousin Elizabeth, in her old age, is pregnant. She's 6 months along. And at that moment, Mary says, okay, let it be. At that moment, Mary says, okay, let it be. She's betrothed to Joseph, right? And now she's pregnant. Where should she go? To Joseph. Where does she go? Verse 39. She goes to Elizabeth. Where's Mary? Nazareth, up in Galilee. Where's Elizabeth? 85 miles away in what we would now call a suburb of Jerusalem. Up in the hill country. Hard going in the hill country. 85 miles apart. How does she get there? We don't know. You want a Christmas miracle? There's a little free Christmas miracle. How old was Mary? We don't know. Keep that answer close to the front of whatever you say to these questions in here. We don't know, but probably early teenager, 14, 15, 16, something like that. Here's a girl, alone, unmarried, making an 85-mile journey up into some of the roughest country around.
6 months pregnant?
No. Elizabeth is 6 months pregnant. Mary has just started. How long does Mary stay with her? Verse 56 in Luke 1. How far along was Elizabeth? 6 months. How long does it usually take? How long was Mary there? Huh. Why did she stay 3 months? She probably stayed long enough. Kim, this is your turn.
To help her.
Okay. Now, look carefully. I am a Westerner. So when I read Scripture, I'm tempted to read it as a Westerner would. Verse 56 said Mary went home. Verse 57 says Elizabeth had the baby. When did Mary go home? Before or after the baby was born? I am taught by my Western training to think, oh, Mary wasn't there. I don't think so. I think the writer says, let's finish about Mary, and now let's start talking about the birth of Elizabeth. Put that little bit in. I think she was there through the birth. I think she stayed the 8 days to the circumcision when they asked her, because he can't speak. They asked Elizabeth's husband, what are we going to name the kid? She said, John. They said, nobody in your family's named John. That's a dumb name to pick. And so in desperation, they went to the husband and said, what are you supposed to name? And he gets a piece of paper and writes. I think he may have been communicating for the first time. I saw my father in the hospital with a tube down his throat. And he wanted desperately to say something to us. We gave him a pad of paper and he couldn't write. I had never seen anybody so frustrated in my life. I think Zachariah, is that right? Yeah. May have been in that position where he wanted to write but couldn't. But that day he could. And what did he write? John. And immediately he could speak again. I think Mary witnessed that. I think she stayed through the birth. And just a little bit beyond. Because she wouldn't have been there that day. 85 miles in that kind of country. She's not going to make that in one day. It's probably going to take her a week or maybe 2 weeks to get there. Plus, she's got to sort of close out things and figure out some excuse for leaving. So I think she was there through the birth. Why was she there through the birth? Oh, what a good day to ask this question. Shepherds had questions and so did Mary. Shepherds had questions and so did Mary. And I would not have thought this thought if I hadn't been to hear Travis this morning. Why did Mary stay through the birth? Is this really going to happen the way the angel said? Is this really going to happen the way the angel said? And it did. Now I can go home. Do you hear a little more of the Christmas story?
Peter and Jeff knew.
I don't know. But I don't think so.
I don't think he knew. She comes back and she
I don't know.
I know, but I'm just saying it could.
I think 3 months had gone by. And she shows up. And she's been out of town. if any of you grew up Southern, yeah, we got 3 minutes left. Can we go look at Joseph for a minute? I know you have a question. Yeah.
I think too that during that 3 months, women when you're young, and women like to talk to each other and share.
Like is not the right word. Have to. No. This one's not funny. She and Elizabeth had to talk. Here's what I experienced, and I don't believe it. Can we possibly find a way that we can both believe it together? Because there's no way we can believe it alone. They had to talk. I wasn't trying to be funny. They had to talk. Absolutely. And it took them 3 months to talk it out. And I don't think Joseph knew until she came back. So let's look at Joseph. Matthew chapter 1, verse 18. We're going to quit with this one. There's more to do, but this is all we're going to do this morning. Matthew chapter 1. You can let Luke go now. Matthew chapter 1, verse 18. Opening sentence. This is how Jesus Christ came to be born. His mother Mary was betrothed to Joseph, but before they came to live together, she was found to be with child through the Holy Spirit. Her husband Joseph, being an upright man and wanting to spare her disgrace, decided to divorce her informally. I have read that thing 5 times, 10 times, 100 times in my life. And very, very recently it hit me. The word "and" is misleading. Joseph, being an upright man, what does that bring with it? You're engaged to somebody, you haven't been with her, and she's got a baby on the way. You're an upright man, and you know the law. What do? You have her stoned. She's executed. Joseph, being an upright man, and wanting to spare her disgrace. Those two things are not in parallel. Those two things are in conflict. Do you hear it? And he goes through an agonizing decision. And what's his agonizing decision? Break off the engagement, break off the impending marriage in a very private way. And maybe send her back 85 miles away where she can live the rest of her life. I bet that's the rest of his plan. And then an angel appears to him in the dreams. Now, I don't have time to take you back to Luke and back to here. If you go to Luke, you may remember Mary was told, you are to name him. Here we are in Matthew. Verse 21. She will give birth to a son, and you must name him Jesus. Because he is the one who is to save his people from their sins. When Joseph woke, he did what the angel of the Lord had told him to do. He took his wife to his home. He had not had intercourse with her when she gave birth to a son. And now listen to the last words. Who named Jesus?
Joseph.
Joseph did. What's the power in those words? Joseph believes and accepts the son as his. My grandfather's name on my mother's side was Magnus Thomas Bass. Isn't that a great name? He ran a woolen mill. He had a partner. He had a wife and family, little girl. He was a teenager, and his wife died. And his partner said, you need somebody to take care of your family. My sister could do that. And his partner's sister came to live in his house as the housekeeper to raise that daughter and to fix the meals and take care of the house. And they fell in love, and they got married. My grandfather died in 1938. My grandmother died almost 30 years later. I guess it was 25 years later. And I thought my grandfather had died at a very young age, but I got my mother talking about this recently, and I found out my grandfather died at close to the age of 80. Because he's that much older than my grandmother. Joseph was not an upright young man. Joseph was an upright man. Magnus Thomas wasn't Joseph. My grandmother wasn't Mary. But I think there might have been a parallel to that. I think there's a maturity in Joseph that says this is a much older man. Maybe with grown children, but maybe with older children. And, you know, you need somebody to take care of the house if you're a working man. And here's this beautiful young girl, and Joseph sees all these good qualities in her, and it's so inconsistent with the condition she's in. And he decided, I don't know what's going on, but I'm not going to make a public spectacle out of her like I know I'm supposed to. And then the angel appeared and said, it's okay. And there's the Christmas story.
I think that's another indication that he's an older man and that he's merciful. I'm not sure of it. The young man will probably be more eager.
That's probably enough for one day. Merry Christmas.